Isn't it funny how the best chats are often had in the car on a long drive? Yeah, you're swapping stories, you're having a laugh, and you're solving the world's biggest problems. So welcome to Car Chats, where we put you in the back seat and get the backstory of some of our favorite humans and hopefully learn something along the way. Okay, welcome to part two of this episode with Hamish Blake. And in this part of our drive together, we discuss how being more playful can help you overcome so many fears that hold us back in life. We also chat about his purpose behind his podcast, How Other Dads Dad, as well as his advice on embracing uncertainty and curiosity. Yeah, something he's learned to be pretty good at given his line of work. To access video highlights from this episode, download the Mojo Crow app, where you'll find a world of content to help you navigate life. Head to mojocrow.com/membership to find out more. Okay, now to part two of this episode with Hamish. And I hope you enjoy the chat as much as I enjoyed taking him for a ride.
Is there a gland that gives out dopamine and cortisol, and you can line ball and suddenly you got a dopamine instead of a cortisol?
Well, yes, it's called perspective gland.
Yeah, cool. Oh my God.
But seriously, similar with anxiety and excitement, they're two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, really.
When you're presenting, and I work with a lot of comedians now as much as athletes and musicians and so forth, it's the same for anyone or a young kid about to give a talk, right? If he's focusing on the things, or he or she's so focusing on the things they can control, they'll be excited.
Yep.
If they're focusing on the things they can't control, geez, what will people think of me? What if the microphone doesn't work? The PowerPoint?
True.
You'll be naturally anxious, right?
Yep.
And the goal for Ash Barty walking the Wimbledon final is to be excited before the game.
Yep.
Especially if the possibility, the opportunity that she's been given, right?
Yes.
And just the appreciation. She gets to play tennis for a living.
Yeah.
That's the first emotion. And then relaxed when you're in the performance.
Yes.
Right? When you get into flow, when you get into that the possibility of give me the ball, I want to see what I can do with it. I want to, because it's not about me.
You know, and that for Ash, but also for entertainers.
Yeah.
That's the moment where you're like, well, she would be thinking, well, I've done the hours. Like, it's all happened, you know, like I think it was a Muhammad Ali quote where he's like, it's all finished. By the time I get to the ring, it's done.
Yeah.
Because
preparation,
I put
was,
the
yeah.
work in.
Yeah.
And I know I've put the work in, and I know I've outworked my opponent before, by the time we step in. So now we're here.
Yeah.
So comedy wise, that can hold true too. Like, you know that you've
practiced
as much as you can. If you're at stand up, like, you know your routine down pat.
Yeah.
And now you're confident enough to see what happens.
Yeah.
And because again, it's that like being able to be present and enjoy, like see events as they're rolling towards you.
Yeah.
That's my favorite space to be in, where you don't know what's coming along, but you're in a great headspace and you can play with whatever's happening.
Totally.
And turn it into something.
There's that word again, play. Curiosity.
Yeah, it's like a little puzzle. It's interesting. My wife and I had this chat, and it's funny, I think we have different attitudes to the unknown. Uncertainty.
Ooh. Uncertainty, yeah.
Zoe is not a fan of it. And I'm not saying that there's a right or wrong here, but I maybe have more, I think it's because I have more examples of uncertainty being a great thing, like yielding positive results.
Mm-hmm.
I've had many, many times in my life where I'm like, wow, like here's a great core memory. And we had no idea that was going to happen, but we just sort of put ourselves in an uncertain environment and we kind of went in with a positive attitude and it manifested well.
Yep.
There's also, of course, danger in uncertainty. Like that's the bad side of uncertainty. And
I think
that's for Zoe, that you know, that's her sort of association with uncertainty. It was like, we got to stamp out uncertainty. We've got to kind of control. We got to control as much as we can.
Yeah.
Things being fluid isn't great.
There's needs for both.
There is needs for both. And then the bad version of that for me is like being like super loosey goosey on the way to the airport. And you could probably just be a bit better organized there.
Totally.
Because super fun thing is going to come from being unplanned for your packing.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
A super fun thing might come when you land in Tokyo and you have a random day. That's fun uncertainty. But just being late to the airport and not having packed on the morning, that's some uncertainty that she could do without.
Totally.
Which I accept.
We all have these, and these aren't wants or goals. These are fundamental human needs.
Hmm.
The first one is actually the need for certainty, for routine, for order, certainty of food, certainty of shelter, certainty of income. But the second one is uncertainty, spontaneity, variety, surprise. If your life's completely certain, it's going to be really freaking boring, right?
Totally.
But if it's completely uncertain, it's going to be chaos.
It's terrifying.
So we need to the balance of the two. And I think what the pandemic called out was, as a human race, we don't do uncertainty very well.
True.
Which means we also don't do vulnerability very well, because certainty and routine have been replaced with uncertainty, unpredictability, vulnerability.
Yep.
Yep. And it's the understanding of leaning into those needs where necessary and see the good that comes from it.
Yeah.
But this illusion of control, this need for certainty, is often what's holding us, a lot of us, back in that regard. So clearly, when you work in improv, right, or in certain areas of comedy, the need to embrace uncertainty, I'd say it's one of the greatest mindset muscles that we can kind of hone in, right? Which I guess is where kind of vulnerability comes in as well. Tell me, what about, you mentioned the sports and entertainment economy kind of thing, and one of the biggest areas to navigate in that world is kind of separating what's real from what's not real, kind of, you know, the person of Hamish Blake versus the persona, right? So if you walk down the street and you get recognized, it's kind of like Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
We don't know you, we know the persona of you.
That's
right?
True.
How have you navigated that? Because it's the same thing from someone who identifies themselves by their business card, you know, in terms of their identity, or even just their career. I'm a banker, I'm a lawyer, I'm a CEO. Or how did you understand what was real?
It's a great question, and I'm glad, A, that we sort of did this early and had our 20s to figure this out.
Yeah.
And B, that you sort of got to bounce it off a mate who was going through the same thing at the same time. And I think for me, really early on, I realized, and this is interesting too, and I think it's relevant to, like, we got recognizable maybe in our mid-20s, but that was still sort of a good 10 years before social media. So that was a different world, maybe five, six years before social media.
Yeah.
It was a different world of recognizability. There still weren't that many people that you recognize. Now it's like a big, and you only came across them on television or billboards or things like that. It was just a different kind of context to it. I've felt it change over the years.
Yeah.
But, you know, really early on for me, it became clear that it was like, I love getting to do what I get to do. And that's not a given. Like, you're not owed a career in radio and television. And it's not just, you know, you're not a special person that deserves this.
Yeah, there's no sense of entitlement.
Yeah, and because if you thought you were entitled to it, then that's the sort of person that would get frustrated by being recognized and things like that. Like, oh, this wasn't part of the deal. And pretty early on, I was like, hey, this is part of the deal. Like, this is part of the deal.
Wow.
You get to have this really fun job and you make crazy money and you get to do what you really love, and there are trade-offs. Like, there are some things you have to probably, you know, especially in commercial radio, like, oh, it's not my favorite thing to do, but I'll do it. Like, and one of the other trade-offs is like, oh, now people will know who you are and you don't know who they are. And that's this thing called fame. And it's not, but I always sort of was able to, well, to me it made sense to put it in that bucket of like, this is a cost of doing business. It's not a terrible cost, because luckily people are always extremely kind. Like, they're excited. They're seeing the persona. Well, you never really know what someone's seeing when they see you, especially nowadays. I'm like, I don't know what thing that you listened to or possibly saw or whatever that is giving you this reaction.
Yeah.
So I always have to, I'm not really sure who you need me to be for persona. I'm also extraordinarily grateful for the audience we have, I have, or that exists that consumes your stuff. Because again, part of the deal is we work in an industry with an audience, you're just doing this into a vacuum, especially commercial television. And you know, like, by its definition, you need people to consume it. And so if they didn't, you wouldn't have a job. So there's that part of me that's like, I'm very grateful for that aspect. And I am grateful to whoever this person is.
Yeah.
I know you don't know me as a person, but it's also, I can't be too bummed about that, because it's a pretty unfair expectation for you to know me as a person. So all you can know of me is a persona.
Yep.
And I get that. And I'm probably, you need me to be something to match the expectation you have of me. The fourth point is, it's probably not very hard for me to be that thing, because this will probably last 10 seconds. And I personally much rather you walk away having your day lightened from the interaction than for whatever reason, I don't know, giving you a, being an asshole and not having time and then
getting frustrated.
I'd be much more upset. That would ruin my day if someone walked away And I don't know what this says about my need to please people, but I would be bummed if I was like, oh, that person, I think I seem like a bit of a jerk to that person.
Yep.
So that's what it's sort of all wrapped up in. It would be nice if everyone knew you as a human being, but I don't think that's possible.
Mm.
I think it's only possible for fame, for famous people to be known as their persona. Unless you are famous for literally, spending hours and hours and hours sharing your deepest, darkest thoughts and all the dimensions of your personality.
Mm.
On that spectrum of like complete persona to person, I think I'm probably closer to the person end anyway. Like my persona's close enough to who I am that I don't think there's any great act going on. So I take some solace from that.
Yeah. Great perspective. Jerry Seinfeld once said there's no such thing as fame school, where you can learn to be famous.
Yeah.
And it kind of stopped me in my tracks, because it's... Yeah, where do you learn to do that separation?
I think you just have to get your head around it to go, hey, this is a part of the deal. What does interest me or fascinate me a little bit is like, a younger generation who are like, I want to be famous. Which to me is like, I don't think you do. I don't really think you know what you're talking about. Because
the double click of that, what does it mean to be famous? It means to be recognized.
Yeah.
Which means I want someone else to recognize me because I want them to give me what I'm not giving myself. I'm not recognizing myself.
Totally. Mate, that's a really good way of putting it. But for me, I'm just like, guys, you don't. You're actually highlighting the cost, not the benefit of my job. And I'm not complaining about the cost, but that is just where it sits on the ledger. Having said that, you do get... I have a lot of positive interactions daily with people that I never would have got to chat to.
Yeah.
A lot of the time it's from podcasting or, you know, those are really sticky audiences.
Yeah.
And I love it. I actually really love it because our Hamish and Andy podcast audience in particular, and for How Other Dads Dad, although that's a slightly different interaction. For podcasting, it's a really deep audience because your podcast audience has listened to every second, you know, of the show. That's not just like flicking past something on TV or on flicking past it on a radio dial.
Yeah.
They're really deep. And it's beautiful because I think like we make those shows with great intentions and we want to have fun and it connects on that level. And so you get to meet people. I love those interactions because you get to meet people who are sharing a laugh with.
Yeah,
and it's totally. Like, it genuinely is like a surprise bump into a friend. And they're often really, really funny people. And that charges my batteries and I walk away always with a smile on my face.
You get as much out of it as they do as well. This internal scorecard versus like an external scorecard.
Yes.
Is this something that's been developed? Because it feels like
maybe
you have developed your own, getting back to your philosophy of life, this perspective, this way of seeing things.
I think maybe again it just organically grew where you realize early on, there is only one way to do this, which is... by your own definition of success and by your own definition of meaning. Because if you're trying to get it from elsewhere, it's actually ludicrous. Like it really is, would be insane to try and derive success from a few random emails that came in from the radio station account or the odd tweet or comment on Instagram. Like if that's really where you were going for success, I think you're going like, this is insane. Because
totally.
The other thing that occurred to me really, really early on, I remember hearing Ricky Gervais talking about this too, who I'm a big fan of, and early days was a really huge fan of. And, you know, he was talking about a similar thing where he was like, someone was like, oh, how are you going to, after The Office, like, your next thing won't be as successful. And he was like, well, what a weird thing to say, because how do you know how I define success?
Wow.
And he was like, you mean how many people watch it? He goes, that's not how I define success. I'm paraphrasing here, but words to that effect, where he was like, you have no idea why I'm making the next thing. Only I know that. And then I get to decide if it's a success or not.
I love that so much.
And so I was like, man, that's just such a good way of putting it. And
redefining success from the intrinsic. So to that point, how would you define success?
Yeah, well,
or the ingredients of it.
I'm glad that even though, you know, it's funny because working in, like, let's say Channel 9, I tell you how people at Channel 9 who are great people and I love working with them, but it's so embedded into the culture you don't even actually examine it. The way TV works is you put something out on air, everyone holds their breath, then the next morning about 9:30 you get the ratings and then people decide if it was a success or not.
Yeah.
And that's just so the way things go. You can, without, unless you think about that, you can get caught up in that.
Totally.
And it's, you know...
And you can't control.
Maybe 10 years ago, I was in that mindset.
Yeah.
But then after a while, you're like, hey, this is actually ridiculous. Like, of course, we don't want to be flippant, and we're great if people watch that works well for Channel 9, and if then you get to do it again, and that's kind of like your reward. But we're like, that has nothing to do... That's nothing to do with my scorecard of success. For me, success for a professional venture is, did we get into it for the right reasons?
Yeah.
Did we try as hard as we could while we were there?
Yeah. In for the right reasons, drive as hard
like
as we possibly could.
Try as hard, like give everything and use all the opportunities and not phone it in. And are you proud of your performance in how you handled your opportunities in the moment? Like, are you proud of... You can only do what you can do with what's there. But are you proud of how you win or lose? Like you know, whether you made a really funny or great thing or not, like, are you proud of how you approached the millions of little opportunities that will come along while you're filming something or while you're recording a show? Are you proud of... And that, like, there's a whole subset of things under that. Like, are you proud of the way you treated people, handled... people look for opportunities, you know, billions of, like, that's the craft. But are you proud of how you went on the day? And that's kind of it. Like, did you get into it for the right reasons? Did you get into it for the right reasons? Did you try your hardest?
Mm.
And are you proud of how you did what you could with what was there? And then I think then you're like, and then is there stuff to learn for next time? And did you feel like, personally, did you grow? Because that is also one of the reasons I do things, is because it seems like a fun adventure, and good adventures, you grow from good adventures.
Which is one of the other needs, the need for growth.
Yeah.
The three biggest needs, you mentioned certainty and uncertainty. The three biggest, in my opinion, is the need for love and connection, the need for growth and opportunity, putting yourself out of your comfort zone, and the need for contribution, you know, to be part of something bigger than yourself,
which is
a family or a partner or a company or so forth. But I want to, there's two last things I want to chat about, and we're kind of touching on the first one, especially as it relates to, and that's probably more a supposition of mine in terms of, I want to talk about purpose, I want to talk about play, but we might touch on purpose because the podcast How Others Dads Dad, I think might have a little element of connection there. I find it fascinating. Robin Williams, one of my favorite comedians and heroes, his purpose was to help people be less afraid.
Oh, that's great.
Jim Carrey's purpose was to free others from concern. I thought it's interesting that
both have other people in their purpose.
Yeah, which I guess effectively is, you know, purpose mindset is to do something for someone else. And the good news is you get complete autonomy to decide who is it you want to do it for and what is it you want to do for them, right? So whether it's a defined statement, right, and you probably talked to Zoe about this as well, or it's just an intention, but if I was to ask you, what do you think your why is or heading towards, what would...
It's a great question, because I would say it's probably changed and has evolved over the years. I would say at the early beginnings, you know, in the 20s, I think it was I'd say it was probably pretty, it was probably more self-centered. I suppose you're like, yeah, we're here to have fun, we're here to do a great thing. You're there to make people laugh, I suppose that's, you know, you are aware you're doing it for an audience, and we have always had a lot of love for our audiences. But as I've got older, I'm much more, I think I've been much more excited by that thing of being like, hey, when you aren't trying to do something because it looks great and you're just doing something because it feels like the right thing to be doing and it taps into who you are and it scratches those itches of curiosity and care and kindness, but it's for other people, and it's also, I think, a key component for me is humorous in some way, or it's never too far away from being allowed to be laughter and joy in it.
Yeah.
Then I've got so much more out of life. Like, I feel I've got so much more, you feel like you're living so much deeper when you're doing that.
Yeah, you're more exuberant, you're more
vibrant. You're just living properly.
Yeah.
Like, it just feels like you're doing the right thing with your day rather than chasing, you know, shiny two-dimensional things as a thing to be doing. So it's that thing of being like, yeah, I think I'm maybe not regular in the industry I'm in because I'm like, I don't really want to be on. I don't desperately need to be on television. I don't.
To define you.
No, I don't. I'm not sitting here going, how can I? What's the next job? How can I stay on TV?
Mm.
I'm really grateful for the opportunities I've had, and I've always loved the projects I've done. That, but because they serve, I guess, that other purpose that I think I'm only really finding out now in the last few years of my life.
Yeah.
I'm realizing that they all feed similar parts of my personality.
Yeah.
But it's not because I love being on TV, and that's not the goal.
Yep.
It just happens to be the arena that kind of fulfills those purposes.
Yeah.
So what is my purpose? This is a great question.
It's also linking into why you created the podcast, I think, in some opinion, because
I think so. I think
obviously having been on the episode with you and listening to you talk about being a dad and the role and watching your eyes dilate when you talk to me about being a dad, that's a very visceral kind of connection you're having with this leadership role of impacting someone else, getting back to, you know, it's about them kind of thing, whether the them is your audience for Hamish and Andy, whether them is your kids or Zoe or friends or whatever it is.
That's it. And I think, so maybe as I've become a dad, that focus slightly shifted from, I was very good at being silly when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
That was probably my superpower.
I'd say you're still relatively good.
But I don't want to lose the silliness too. I'm not looking to grow up in that sense. I never really want to lose that in a child.
Yeah.
Because I do think that's part of who I am. And it's a special part too. Like, you don't want to have you don't want to dull that down. But I think as I've grown up into being a dad and into being trying to be a better human and man, that idea of that leadership, that loving leadership idea, has come more into play as well.
Yeah.
Insofar as going first, like doing something, creating something that is for other people, even though you're nervous to do it, and listening to that voice a little bit more, and having the courage to go on adventures and to create adventures, perhaps with a bit more purpose and meaning, that are about deeper things in life.
Yeah.
And never losing touch with that silly person, but I think you mentioned curiosity before too, which I reckon I've never really connected those dots, but I think that really resonates with me, that word. I think I'm a curious person.
Yeah.
And I think I was silly curious when I was younger, and now perhaps more playfully adventurous and curious, but with a bit more of a deeper meaning behind some of those adventures.
Well, it's the intention behind the childlikeness or the laughter or the spontaneity. It's you're not doing it for your sake, even though you get more out of it than others.
Totally.
You're doing it for the impact that you can have on someone else. But your curiosity to kind of realize your potential and the possibility of what you can do there, like you said, when you're on stage, you just give me the red ball.
Yeah.
That's kind of feels like it's connecting.
And you know, I haven't really discussed this much because I didn't really think it was relevant, but I think it is relevant here. Before I did have other dad's dad, that was just a thing that came from, you know, that bubbled up internally. And maybe I'd had this sort of that germ of an idea for a few years, but it wasn't in any shape. But I was like, look, being a dad is the most important thing that's ever happened to me. And I know a lot of other guys feel the same, but there's that feeling of not sure if you're doing it right. You just suddenly end this thing with no playbook. And so that feeling was there, but then creatively to want to make this show and figure out what it was, what I sort of realized a few things earlier. I was like, this is not going to be that. I don't think the temptation is to make it funny, but I think that will perhaps stop it going as deep as it could go in some areas. And I think that's what I want to hear, deeper stuff. Like,
the humor will come from the kids.
That's it. And I was like, as someone that's seeking sort of fatherly wisdom, I of course it can be funny, and it is a funny show sometimes, but it can't be the point, because I think there's enough stuff out there about, there's enough comedy around being a dad.
Yeah.
And I reckon it will stop us going deep.
Yeah.
And if it becomes the point. So I was like, okay, that's kind of really scary for me to admit that to myself, that it might not be a funny show.
Yeah.
Because immediately I felt kind of a bit
your persona's
naked.
Your persona's been challenged.
So this was a huge battle I had internally. Like, and I've talked about this with Tim, who I make the show with. And, Tim's known me since I was in year 9. He's like, man, I just don't really even understand why this would be a worry for you. I was like, yeah, it was a huge fear to go, oh, you're going to put this thing in the world and it's not funny. And the people that know you as being someone that's trying to make funny content, it runs a huge risk of just people going, what is this? And so I was really, really scared to battle internally with that a lot. I was really scared that people would be like, hey, get back in your box. You're not this guy. You're just the guy that we go to when we need some silly stuff. And my biggest, well, I actually probably had, this is really deep, I probably had two fears.
Yeah.
One, that people would say that, like, what are you doing not being funny? And probably my deeper fear was that I would listen to them.
That you would what?
I would listen to them.
Oh, listen to the man in the
and
arena.
I would get back in the box.
Wow.
I would get back in my box. So that was probably my deepest
fear. And you're a dad for life as well, right? So
yeah, that's it. And then so then I was playing with it and I was like, well, I just can't let that be the reality. Yeah. I can't let that drive me here. Like, it's when you actually like lay it out like that, you're like, oh my God, it's so clear what you have to do here. Do this thing that's scary and but you think is a good thing to do, or I don't know, listen to some idiots that have a go at you for doing it. Like, you just can't let that be the option. You must do this now because those two options have entered your head, and if you don't do it, you're capitulating to this imaginary these imaginary people that will have a problem with it.
Hence,
and of course, no one had a problem. No one's had a problem. No one has. No, I'm sure there's people that it's not for them, but no one's like actively heckling me for doing it.
Well, the fact is that mums are listening to it as well, right? So it's less about. I mean, yes, there's a gender split on certain nuances of being a dad versus a mum.
Totally.
But you're getting back to purpose mindset. If you define purpose as creating an environment to help others realise their potential. If you define leadership as creating an environment to help others realize their potential, and if you define parenthood as creating an environment to help others realize their potential, you can do that through comedy,
right?
To help people with their perspective, not to take life too serious. My favorite quote of all time, bumper sticker, is not a shred of evidence exists in favor of the idea that life is serious. I think that Edward Hill, whatever his name is, like he said that 150 years ago, right? So 150 years ago, he made that comment. Think about where we are today.
It's true.
So you can help someone with comedy and make them feel better, right, and get more playful, or you can help them with learning from stories of other dads about how they overcame issues and challenges and so forth. It's exactly, when you put your purpose hat on, it's exactly the same thing. You're just showing up in a different way, and I'm sure you'd be the same with your family or friends in terms of your why. You just, getting back to your curiosity, it's just this curiosity how I can bring that to life in different aspects of my life.
Totally.
But if it's finite, right, defined as I'm a comedian, well, what does that mean? When you're no longer doing it, does that mean your life has no purpose anymore or no meaning and so forth? So it's literally just lifting the aperture lens a bit. And tapping into that. And I agree with Tim.
You're very good.
I think you're already there. One last question, and then I definitely owe you a sandwich or a cafe near your house, is around play.
Yes.
Right? We talk about dreams earlier, and the opposite of dreams is kind of fear on some level. I also think the human race has lost the art of it and understanding just how fundamental it is. And I think it's another one of your signature strengths, and you've mentioned a few times already. Harvard did a study to identify, it's gone for 100 years, right? The six reasons why people go to work.
Yeah, great.
The number one reason is play.
Awesome.
When a psychologist tries to help someone get into the flow state, right, the number one ingredient is play.
Yeah.
Of the three intrinsic motivations that we're seeing coming out of the pandemic for people that are flourishing rather than languishing, the number one issue is play. And when an athlete comes to me super stressed, because they're so worried about opinions of others or they've got to win and focusing on the results, we remind them that it's called a game, and a game is based on three things: compete, have fun, and play. So everywhere you look at the world, we've forgotten to be playful.
That's it. People are competing, but they forgot to have fun.
Yeah.
They're not sparring anymore.
Yeah.
They're playing for real.
Is it something that you naturally fell into, or did you teach yourself, or do you actually understand how powerful it is? Because you are kind of like the official ambassador of play in a way, whether you like it or not.
That's very kind. I'll put it to you this way. I'm like, going back to life is not meant to be serious. I firmly agree. In fact, one of my triggers is being upset unnecessarily. So I reckon the at the core of this is going, don't, you know, like, again, finite days, really finite time on the planet. And, it, you know, I suppose easy to be upset. A lot of things you could easily be upset about or, you know, like, you know, shitty about, and valid things too.
Yeah.
But let's just assume that we want to get to the end of our life and not look back and be like, oh, geez, I could have been having a bit more fun. I think fun was a really important part of my life from early on to just not... I mean, because, again, it's that thing of, like, the option is not having fun, and that doesn't seem acceptable. So the easiest way to have fun is to play games in life, is to create games. Like, I think a lot of what Ando and I ended up doing is playing games. I just like the spirit of play because it can turn an ordinary day. You know, you can create a laugh out of nowhere, and I think laughs are they're precious. They're underrated.
Totally.
They're a really...
A laughing Buddha.
They're a very special commodity, and I think as a tool to create laughter and smiles and enjoyment out of nowhere, games and play is a very easy way to do it.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the tenets that the games had to have, but I suppose also competing. Compete,
have fun, and play.
And competing can be an intense thing, but I think the reason, I think a secret of just great games, and this is with kids or with mates, there's fun in deciding rules. Like, there's fun in... We always just had fun in... That's a game in itself is determining the structure of the game.
Yeah.
Like, that's a great bonding experience. And I think kids are really good at that too. Like, they learn how to set the rules. You see it in playgrounds all the time. Like, this is in, this is
out. Yeah, the imagination's constantly going crazy.
Refining it, and it gives you, like, that sense of fairness. And then it's fun and funny to then learn all the different permutations of the rules that you can, like, challenge and, you know, loopholes and whatever.
Yep.
And that's where the camaraderie comes from. But I think it's always important, like, to really capture that feeling of you're not playing for... I actually love playing for keeps. And I don't think...
Interesting.
I didn't... Like, you know, sport was really not part of my life. And that competitiveness of, like, crushing the opposition and, like, you know, that foot on the throat.
Yeah, kill or be killed.
That just never factored in my makeup of childhood. My version of play is, like, you know, if we're all laughing at the end of it or an unexpected moment happens, like, that's the gold. Yeah. That is the goal of any game, is for a silly or a great moment to happen or just a moment.
Yeah.
You try to create moments out of thin air, and I guess games are the ultimate way to do that. So I always think of it that way, and Ando and I would often talk about, like, our chemistry, our banter is playful, and we're taking, like, slight shots at each other all the time. But we always talked about, like, you know, we'd see other, there's no right or wrong way to do this. We can go left and get back to one.
Yep.
There's no right or wrong way to do this. But we were always like, it's fun for both sides. Like, that's the other part of play. Maybe it comes back to, again, thinking of other people. You're trying to create an environment where it's fun and fair for both sides. Like, just mercilessly berating someone is not play. That's not play at all. But having finding a funny topic, say on the podcast, that we both can have differing ideas about, even if it involves taking pot shots at each other, that's play, because it's fun and it's sparring. Totally. We were always like, it's got to be sparring. If it starts feeling like UFC, it's actually not even sparring. It's got to be WWF. It's got to look funny and dramatic, but no one's getting hurt.
Yeah, totally.
If it starts to become UFC, we've got a problem, because we're not here to, like, literally bloody each other's noses.
Yeah.
We're here to play.
Totally.
And whether it was, like, inventing games, like small games, big games, or just simply the style of conversing, that's probably always been how I look at it. Like, we're here to create moments out of nothing. And I think, especially with kids, that's all play needs to be. Like, you're just here to create a moment where there wasn't one, instead of just sitting on the couch staring into space. You are here to just create any moment. And the best advice, I can't remember where I got this from, but I always think about this, and it comes up in a podcast a fair bit, is, like, you are the game. Like, just being there with them and letting their imaginations run wild. You don't have to come up with a great game, and it doesn't have to be complicated or expensive or whatever. Be there and listen to your kids, even if it's for 10 minutes, and play whatever game they want to play. And the fact that you're there, you're the game. like, that's fun for them, is that mum or dad is on the ground.
Oh, I love that.
And you're the game.
I might steal that.
Steal it. I stole it, so you can steal it. I'm just, no, you steal stolen goods.
But everything you've just defined, the subset of play that you've just been describing is spontaneity.
Yeah.
Which I heard defined once as a sense of freedom where everything is on offer.
Yes.
And you kind of tap into the three things. Notice more. So have this awareness, this kind of mindful attention. So you just notice things more. You let go.
Yep.
You let go of fear of other people's opinions, and embrace vulnerability kind of as a strength. And you use everything around you.
Yeah.
Everything's on offer. Everything's on offer.
And that's what I think is really important in a game. Games are really an opportunity for you to get creative and make fun decisions in the moment. And I think when you're with any form of play, it's like there are serious words involved, but they have to be approached in a fun way. Like competing is a serious word, but games are great when it's fun.
Yeah.
Fairness is a serious word. But there's a lot of fun in fairness and in determining what's fair and what's
things being equal.
And, and if you're having fun in determining fairness, I find that really funny, and that's a really enjoyable part of the game.
Yeah.
So I guess it's like looking at the serious part, like if you make the analogy of like sport, like the serious part of all the components of sport, but you make it fun. Like you make it, that's part of, it becomes play when you make serious stuff fun.
Totally. And those three ingredients, right? Notice more, let go, and everything's on offer. It's effectively the definition of improv acting, right?
Totally.
To bring that to life. I remember watching you many, many years ago on Thank God You...
Yes, Thank God You're Here.
Thank God You're Here, right? And I remember Malcolm Gladwell, one of my favourite authors, wrote a beautiful book called Blink, on intuitive thinking.
Yep.
And he speaks about improv acting in the same way he speaks about sport. And he said, I think he said the number one rule, the first rule of improv acting is you must accept what happens to
you.
Totally, yep. Because if you don't, that's where the humour is. If you don't accept it, it's not funny, right?
Yep.
So I feel like, I genuinely feel like the world needs to learn how to improv act.
Yeah.
So we get more present, more curious, more open, more spontaneous, more playful.
And
bring that to our, like literally bring that to life today.
Totally. And I'm no expert on improv at all, and I don't know the theory of it, but I will say, I know some people hear that, like we have to accept, like you have to say yes
to
what is happening.
Yeah.
And it can read like or sound like a favour to be like, oh, okay. If a person goes, oh man, we're in the jungle, you have to say yes, and the monkeys are vampires or whatever. But you can feel like that first yes is a give, is like a favour to the other person. Be like, all right, well, we've accepted your premise.
Yeah.
But what you realise in life is it's not a favour, it's just 100% the way. Like whatever the grand outcome is of this scene, it only will work if you, it's a gift. It's always a gift. Even if it seems like not a gift at the time, you just have to treat it as a gift.
I love that.
And you
acceptance
have to,
is a gift.
You just have to go with it, because if done well at the end of the scene, it will inherently have been a gift that first thing happened. Even if you had a different idea in your head, like this is very, when you start doing improv like in year 9, you're like, oh, it'd be awesome if we're on a space station. And then someone says, we're on a rowboat. You're like, damn it, what if we're on a space station? But that's not acceptance. That's just you thinking that it would have been cooler in your
totally.
Idea.
But treating acceptance as a gift, do you know, probably it's the number one mindset muscle on the planet that we need to train up.
Yeah.
The power of acceptance.
And I mess that up all the time too. And then it takes me a while to get there. And then I'm like, man, if I'd have just accepted this, and like whatever that martial art is where you go with Aikido, whatever, where you would go with your opponent's energy. Like if I'd have just done that from the start, I would have, it's probably all of them, but I would have saved myself a lot of energy here.
Totally.
Because it was the only move available. I just thought there was other moves available.
Accepting the things you can't control, number one. Form of acceptance. And the second one is just accepting yourself.
Totally.
Unconditionally. You don't put any conditions or labels or personas on it. And then from that place, you can have confidence in yourself and others. And in my opinion, that's when you can contribute to their journey. And I guess that's just called living. Yeah.
So good.
So I think we've nailed it. I think
that was a great drive.
That was a fun drive.
Okay, that's it for part two of this episode of Car Chats with Hamish Blake. To access video highlights from this episode, download the Mojo Crow app, where you'll find a whole world of stories and helpful content to help you navigate life, including our free perspective intervention, which is a short form exercise designed to help you flip your perspective in real time. Head to mojocrow.com/membership to find out more.